So, the first question was, I know you enjoy collecting objects, some of which you incorporate into your found artworks. What do you look for and what inspires you to go hunting, Peter?
I have various collections which are simply collections. I collect a kind of category that you could call folk art, and I collect collages, and I collect toy miniature elephants, and I collect hats. There are a lot of things which are simply collections. And then other times, it would depend on really what I'm working on. I'm working on a show at the moment, for a show at Waddington in the autumn, which is called Homage 10 by 15. So I'm taking 10 artists and making 5 works in homage to each of them. And so, for instance, one of the artists is H.C. Westerman, and he did a series of sculptures called the Death Ships. So I'm doing a series of sculptures incorporating galleons. So, which is very bizarre. Because
how many have you collected?
Well, I only collected what I needed, so I think 5. You know. Yeah. So, but that was an odd thing to be looking out for. And you go into a junk shop, and instead of looking for what you might have been looking for a year ago, suddenly you spot a galleon. You know. So, and that would just depend what I'm working on.
Yes. Do you troll through eBay and things like that as well?
I don't even look at it. Right? Someone.
Oh, you're not technical.
Yeah, did. Someone showed it to me once, and I thought this would kill you. Yeah. I'd be on it. Or I'd become an addict. Yeah. Here, so.
Yeah.
So occasionally, when I'm at Coriander, we look it up and see which of the signatures I've done in the last year has turned up on eBay, for instance.
Yeah.
But I don't buy from it, and I don't put things on. And the only time I did, via Coriander, there was there's a George Gross book called Ecce Homo.
Yeah.
And this was an original version for £80, and I bought that, and it never turned up.
Oh, really?
So that was my first experience,
right.
And my last.
So, but you can go back, and because you can give feedback on sellers, can't you? So presumably he would have really bad feedback.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I tried selling something on eBay for the first time about 2 or 3 months ago, just to sort of get the process going. And it was a little safety razor, but a really early one. It was 1905,
yeah.
Really unusual thing, in its original chrome case.
Yeah.
And I went through the whole process of putting it on. It was quite complicated, and then you can watch it. And I was watching it every day, and, you know, first day 20 people had looked at it,
yeah.
The next day 40 people had looked at it, and by the end, something like 150 people had looked at this thing, and I was like, oh, God, it's going to be a fortune! And this thing had cost me £20. And on the day of the sale, it made £6.
No, well, that's sad, isn't it? I've watched them do it there, and there's usually people wait to the last second, don't they?
Yeah.
So they get the last bid in. Mm. So there's a flurry towards the end,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But there was no flurry.
No.
Oh, that's sad.
You mentioned last night. Tell me about the first time you went to an auction. What was it like?
It was an auction in Bath, and it was a book auction, and as I said last night, I'd never been to an auction before, so I quickly realised what you did, you raised your hand and you caught the auctioneer's eye and things like that, but I didn't quite understand the way it worked. So if something came up and there were no bids on it, it would go down and down and down, and then the auctioneer would say, well, just give me £5. And so everything that started off like that, I was bidding on. So I was getting everything, including, as I said, a complete set of Cornhill magazines and a complete set, a set of an early LaRouche dictionary, which I then, as I told you, I kept for some years, and then more recently I've cut it up and used it in the collages.
Yes.
But I just was bidding on everything. So I had to get a taxi to take me back to my house in all these things. I had no idea what I'd got.
Yeah.
But it was exciting.
Yeah.
And that started a
Well, that started, you know, I still go to auctions, but I can control things now. I mean, I pretty much go just for what I want, and I know when to stop. You know,
yes.
I've never been carried away completely.
Yes. And you go to boot fairs and things like that?
I go to one. I hadn't been until about a year ago, and I go to the Chiswick one, which is a good one.
Yes. Also, I think you mentioned last night, skit finds.
They're pretty rare. I mean, that might be the only time I've ever found anything on the skip. But,
yes.
But it was a couple of windows and some doors, and some of those early pop-up pieces. Your toy shop was made with a door and a window from a skip. And I think one of the door pieces, one door became three different pictures. You know, I cut the top off, and then the other pieces became a piece of a door. So one door made three of those early pop-up door pieces.
Yes.
But I'm not a kind of habitual skip climber into.
Yeah, have you worked out how many different collections you've got within your collection?
I haven't, no. I suppose it must be kind of 25-30, I suppose.
Yes.
Because there's badges, there's books and different categories of books, and books about wood engraving. You know, I collect wood engravings, I collect photographs, you know, so they're all kinds of, they're capsule collections. I mean,
yes.
the photographic collection is tiny, you know, it's probably only 10 things, but it's got some Dianarbus contact sheets, and it's got a Julia Margaret Cameron photograph, and it's got a Lewis Carroll photograph, so it's quite a tight, nice little collection.
Yeah. Do you remember from early on what started your collecting passion? Was that before you went to Gravesend? Was it Gravesend?
Yes, there was no chance of it happening before then, so I think as soon, the circumstances were that, you know, I was seven when the Second World War started, so I was evacuated twice during the war, and I didn't really collect it. I suppose I collect things like the Scout magazine. You know, I mean,
right.
but there was no opportunity to collect really. And there were no such things as badges. Or I suppose in a way I collected comics. But the door opened really when I went to Gravesend School of Art at the age of 14, the junior art department, and next to the railway station there was a junkyard. It was about 10 feet wide. It was on a strip of land right next to the road, but it was about 100 feet long. So at the beginning was a Nissen hut with things undercover. And then once you went out of the back of the Nissen hut into this unexplored territory,
yes.
The farther you went, you found wonderful things.
Yes,
I mean, at the far end of it,
fantastic.
I suppose it was old wooden things overgrown.
Yes.
But you know, there were wonderful things. And that day I bought a painting of the Queen Mary, a Sunday painting, outsider art picture, a papier-mâché tray, and a set of Shakespeare plays, leather-bound.
Yes.
So I bought an instant library, and I bought a piece of folk art, the tray, and a piece of art, I suppose.
Yes.
And it went from there.
I know you have a fascinating folk art collection, and I'm really interested in the perception of ordinary objects when we take them away from their everyday function and context and put them in under the spotlight or, you know, on a pedestal or, you know, onto the wall, and they become found art or art, because you've made that decision that it's become art.
Yeah.
In its own right. I guess I don't know what my question is. Where do you perceive the difference between found art and folk art?
Well, I think found art, I don't think I coined it, but it's an extension of the found object. I mean, one's talked about found objects for some years. The actual phrase found art applies really to this series of prints I'm doing where I find a piece of ephemera, scan it, and then print it out in inkjet, and sometimes quite large. So that's what that's really saying is This is something which is mundane and has no aesthetic sense, or is nothing until I do this process with it. So that could be a cigarette packet, or a matchbox, or a piece of paper, or a badge, or pretty much anything. So that's a whole separate concept. But the concept of the found object is a different one. Where I might find some pieces of driftwood, and again, which have no aesthetic value, but by putting them together, you make something with them. I think they're two different things.
Yeah. No, it's just, because I was thinking from, my perspective, I've grown up with, in the antique world, sort of looking at objects and things. All everyday objects eventually, become interesting, collectible, because of their antiquity.
Yeah, and to somebody, wants them, isn't it?
Modern everyday items aren't interesting until they're taken out of context and we're forced to look at them in a different way, like, Marcel Duchamp.
Yeah, exactly. He was the precursor of it, and he was the man who gave us all the right to do that and discovered it and invented it.
Have you ever taken an object without putting it in juxtaposition with anything else and just exhibited it in its own right?
I've curated a couple of shows, including one of sculpture. And I think in that there would have been found objects that I exhibited as sculptures.
Yes.
I can't quite remember what, but I would have done. Yeah.
I love the Nash's two lumps of burnt wood.
Beautiful, isn't it?
Two lumps of charred wood that are just.
David Nash, we should point out, because Paul Nash also made pieces with found wood, didn't he?
Yes.
He made some little sculptures. But that particular piece, the story behind that is that every Christmas he makes a piece of sculpture. I mean, I don't know whether he still did, but in the early 70s, when I bought that. So this was the piece he made that Christmas, and it's strips of oak about an inch square, and made into an open box, and then he burnt two logs, and the burnt kind of balls of wood are placed within this box, and that's the object. And the circumstances of my buying it were that he had a show at the Arnolfini in Bristol, and on the last morning of the show, I lived in Bath, so I'd gone over to Bristol. I didn't really know his work particularly, but an hour before the show closed, he hadn't sold one piece, and I thought that's so kind of sad that I'll buy it. I think I bought three pieces for £25 each. Yeah, fantastic, really. That piece and a nest made of bark, where he took four pieces of bark and then you made a nest of it, and a little ladder, I think I bought.
Yes.
And then he gave me a big, important piece, which was a split log piece. And then
were those works the first found art works by another artist that you've purchased into?
Probably not. No, yeah. I probably got
the
things.
What?
I can't remember what would it be.
Okay.
No,
which is the most treasured object or work of art?
It changes, but it would include, within the collection is this kind of special little collection, which is it's a pair of Max Miller's shoes and a Max Miller walking stick. Max Miller was the comedian.
Yes.
The shoes worn by boots worn by General Tom Thumb, the American dwarf with Barnum and Bailey, a hat worn by Douglas Fairbanks in the Robin Hood film of 1922.
Did you buy that from Christie's?
I bought that from Christie's, I did. You may have sold it too.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, I don't think it was me personally, but I think.
But whoever did, I think they kind of knocked it down to me, because there was very little bidding on it, and it went very quickly. So it may have been someone who ended it quickly.
Yes.
But because it wasn't too expensive. And so they're the kind of probably the most precious object. But then there are precious books.
Yes.
I've got the book of Penny Toys. I forget the artist's name. but it's hand coloured wood engraved books. So I've got some quite rare books.
One of the questions was, if you were marooned on a desert island and you were allowed to take with you one work of art from any period, anything, what would you take?
I think because of the circumstances, it might well, there's a particular Brancusi sculpture, and I think it had been, it's a wooden sculpture, and I think it had been a sculpture of a baby, but it's only a fragment, it's the head from it, and it's just a kind of ball of wood with a wedge cut out of it, which was probably the baby's mouth, and it's just such a beautiful kind of, it's a beautiful piece of wood. It's an extraordinary, I love Brancusi anyway, so I think that would probably take that. I mean, I would also I would love to have the Las Meninas, but that not on the desert island, unless I made a tent with it or something. So I'm thinking in terms of practicability, but, and I could take that off with me when I left.
Yes, yeah.
But I mean, relative to that question, I've done desert island discs twice, in fact.
Oh, have you? Okay.
And when the first one, when asked what luxury item would I take, I said, "Can I take David Hockney?" And they said, "What, a David Hockney?" I said, "No, David Hockney." And I explained that that I'm not gay, but David's a good friend of mine. We have great conversations, and I like him very much. And they said, "No, you can't take that." So
yeah.
I forget what I then chose. The second time, I think I chose. I was quite plump at that point, and I decided it would be very nice to see my stomach muscles once in my life, so I took a home gym. But I never did anything about
Fantastic.
It, and I've never seen them.
The next question was, did you ever...
found some?
Yeah.
How would you like to do it? Choice. Should we do the photograph and then carry on?
Do you want to?
What do you want?
It'd be quite nice to walk
into you. Yeah? Do you mind if Tempe just takes photographs as we walk around? Or?
No, that's fine.
Yeah?
Is that okay?
Yeah, so we'll finish this bit of it, shall we?
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back and forth.
Yeah, and then we'll walk around. Yeah.
It's
just there.
Yeah.
It's the door to the right there, yeah.
Did you ever consider choosing another career other than art, or did you always know that you wanted to be an artist?
Well, I went into art so young that there wasn't really... I didn't think I would go into art. That was pure chance that I got into Gravesend Technical School, and at the interview they said, the art school is part of the technical school. If you want to go to the art school, you can pop around the corner and take a drawing examination. So I was kind of presented with the opportunity completely out of the blue. So I suppose in going to a technical school, my family... my dad was an electrician, so I probably would have gone towards that, towards the building trade.
Yeah.
But suddenly at 14, so I didn't ever really have to think about it,
yeah.
Because it was given to me very, very young. But sort of fantasy, when asked this question, the Sunday Times did an article called This Chain of Life, where they asked a doctor what he would have chosen to be if he wasn't a doctor.
Yes.
And then... He said he would have liked to have been an artist, but didn't specify. So they chose me as his artist.
Right.
And when I really had to think about it, I ended up. I said something about perhaps working in wood in some way, but I then decided I wanted to be a professional wrestler, but specifically. Kendo Nagasaki. So they then asked Kendo Nagasaki what he would have been.
Yeah.
He would have liked to have been Richard Branson with his sort of business acumen. And then Richard Branson, it went round about 20 people because somebody wanted to be a doctor and the chain was completed. So when I actually had to decide, it was a professional, it's Kendo Nagasaki. So that would have been my career.
Kendo was your favourite
wrestler. Yeah.
Do you have his mask? Am I dreaming?
Yeah, that's one of my other treasured objects.
Yes.
And I made a film with him eventually. So that, in a way, that dream was fulfilled because we made a film for the South Bank show. For Arena. And during that, I was completely dressed in his complete outfit, with the cloth mask and the kendo mask and the sword, and it was at in Stoke, and the wrestling ring was set up for that evening's wrestling, and Kendo said, "Well, just walk. There's nobody around. Just walk out to the ring, climb in the ring." So I went out from the dressing room, and I was suddenly strutting, and looking up, sort of looking up angrily into the gods where there was nobody there. But I actually was Kendo, and I climbed through the ropes, and then we filmed a sequence of me pretending to be him. Yeah. It didn't work because I didn't look anything like him, and when they actually filmed it, this fat little man was not at all convincing, so we didn't use it, but he showed me how to roll along the ropes,
right,
yeah. You had to block a punch and things,
yes,
like that, so I became him, so the fantasy was achieved.
You obviously watched wrestling with your mum and dad.
I worked with my mum and my aunt. Yeah. From in 1947.
Yeah.
So as it started up again after the war,
yeah,
I was going pretty much to the first bout. So. Some of the answers are so long.
No, that's good. No, it's fantastic. That's really fantastic. I don't know how we're going to edit them.
Oh, I don't want to.
No, exactly. Yeah. Be writing another book.
Yeah. Don't tell me.
Where did I get to?
What alternative occupation would I have?
Yes. Your mum was obviously very influential. Was she very supportive when you went to art school? She supported you.
Yeah, she's a Geordie. She'd come down from South Shields in the early 30s, and met my dad, I think she was in service at first, somehow. And then she was a seamstress, so she worked in the hospital in Dartford. My dad, as I said, was an electrician. And they were supportive when they needed to be. I mean, when I got a place at art school, they had to decide whether they could afford to let me go. I mean, it wasn't a matter of supporting me, because I got grants anyway. But it was a matter of, the tradition then was that you're at the age of 14, you left school, and you started to contribute. So so it was just understood.
I didn't mean financially, I meant,
it was important that they could let me go to art school financially. But, they certainly supported. They sometimes didn't know what I was doing, even though it was pretty straightforward. But I don't know what Damien's mum thinks, but they were supportive,
that's
yeah.
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 That's great, thank you. You were classically trained at the Royal College of Art back in the 1950s. How did that training sit with you and the other artists there at the time who went on to be part of such a groundbreaking art movement?
Well, again, the answer must be slightly long, because what happened was the sequence of events was that at Gravesend, as you said, I did this very kind of classic. I did the last year of the intermediate examination in 1950. The last year it was done in that form, and it had gone back to Victorian times, so I learned wood carving, stone carving, lettering, wood engraving, anatomy, perspective, architecture. I mean, it's a very broad course, a very good education. And then I wanted to be a painter, but the staff at Gravesend School of Art advised me that it was a precarious way to make a living and to do the commercial art course. So I did a year of the National Diploma in Commercial Art, tried for the Royal College halfway through the course, to be a graphic designer, and sent one painting, and Sir Robin Darwin saw the painting, and they accepted me into the painting school. So it was a very odd course of events, and then I left Gravesend. So I was only halfway through the graphic design course. You had to do national service, so I did 2 years in the Air Force, and then went to the Royal College at the still young age. I was just 21 by then, and rather like suddenly being an artist at 14 at Gravesend, you know, suddenly I was on the painting course, never having been a painting student.
Yeah.
So that was the background to getting there. But the people around me, the people in the year ahead of me, Bridget Riley was in that year, Brent Carbach, Bradby was doing a fourth year.
Collection of people.
Yeah, the kitchen sink painters had left the year before, so you know, Jack Smith and that group of artists, Derek Greaves, and Ted Middleditch. In my year, there was Leon Kossoff and David Troostwyck, mainly, oddly enough, women artists in that year. Julia Wolstenholme married Frank Auerbach. And then the year after me was Richard Smith, Robin Denny, Bill Green, and that generation that continued, you know, that were the kind of abstract, British abstract expressionists. And then what's sometimes misunderstood, people assume I was there with David Hockney. In fact, you know, I was there from 53 to 56, and that extraordinary year came in 59. So it was 6 years after me.
Yeah.
And that was Hockney, Kitai, Alan Jones, Peter Phillips, Derek Boucher. I mean, that was an amazing, extraordinary year. Patrick Caulfield the year after that. So I was sometimes associated with that particular group, but I wasn't part of that. I met them,
and
became friends with them, but I wasn't part of it.
No, absolutely. It's just interesting because then there's a very formal structure of training with such an influence and a group of people who were fundamentally changing, you know, questioning art.
Well, questioning the course, I suppose,
yes.
because you had to... Everybody had to go into the life room for the whole of the first year.
Yes,
you either drew or painted or sculpted from the model, and that was compulsory. I mean, there's no question of that. But I think what happened, at that point, once you were allowed out of the life room, you either went into the still life room, which was very traditional, you know, with a cupboard,
yes,
you know, with a trumpet and you know, some books and those kind of still life half boxes where you'd set up your still life with a drape,
yes,
you know, and some fruit. So you either went on and did that, or there was a room called the composition room where you'd go and paint compositions. So it was in the tradition of you will paint a street with some workmen and a dog and a bus. Quite often the picture was prescribed to you. And I think we were the generation that just started painting what we wanted to paint.
Yeah.
So I found a little corner, which you didn't do, and I made myself a studio. I think I put a Victorian settee into it and a palm tree and made myself a little nest, your little corner, and just started to paint.
Did the tutors challenge that?
They didn't. They let it happen, but it happened very quickly after that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I wasn't the first, I imagine, but it's now very much a tradition that you have your own space, whereas before you'd work in an open space.
Yeah.
You'd have your own few feet around you, but you'd have no walls, you know. You'd have no... But I made a wall, you know, and I made a very tight space. And I painted those early pictures like children reading comics and those mid-50s pictures that were kind of autobiographical, and they became the first pictures in my branch of pop art.
Mm.
I mean, all these explanations go on into other explanations.
Yes. That's really interesting, thank you. Sorry to bring it back up again, but one of the things that I picked up on last night was a question from the audience where you suggested, and I think having looked this morning, you're probably right, you were the first artist to actually put a celebrity into a picture in the mid-1950s, I think, and nobody had ever done that before.
Perhaps not. I mean, I've never claimed that.
Was that a conscious decision, or was it just... a sort of freedom of experimentation? Or
it was because probably you know, the paintings were autobiographical. Yeah, you know, I suppose I was saying, you know, this is a person that I like. You know, so this is about my life. You know, so I mean things like the locker which is upstairs, you know, which at the back is covered with pictures of Brigitte Bardot.
Oh, yeah.
And the front is covered. The back is Kim Novak, and the front is Brigitte Bardot. I think.
Yes.
So I think that was a breakthrough. I mean, using a piece of furniture, an actual locker, and calling it art, and covering it with an explanation of who I like. You know, so maybe in terms of dates, that probably did precede the Warhol. But I've never particularly claimed that.
No.
It was an interesting point. I mean,
fascinating.
I tried not to be influenced by Warhol, but assumed I probably had been. I mean, I accept I was influenced very much by Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns in some of those early pop pictures. I mean, the idea of an area and then a strip of information at the top, you came directly from Jasper's work. But it was interesting. The point that was made that maybe Warhol did know what I was doing.
You have many friends in the pop music industry and you've produced many album covers for various artists. How influential has music been to your work and which artists do you listen to today?
I think the crossover has been very influential. I mean, the fact that I met The Who in 64 and they became friends, and The Beatles and Mick Jagger live 50 yards away from me in Dartford, so I've always had these kind of links. So that has been very important. And I try and think more or less what I played in the last week. I played some Chet Baker music, Peggy Lee I played yesterday, Talking Heads I like very much. Jerry Lee Lewis. Rock and roll album, singing other people's songs, so singing lots of Chuck Berry songs that I played yesterday. Dionne Warwick I played quite often. So it's a pretty broad, lots of jazz, you know, lots of modern jazz.
Do you listen to music when you're actually working, Peter?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, so if I'm in here, I've got a little CD player in the corner, and if I'm in the studio, I play LPs, play records.
And the last question was, you've received numerous awards, honours and commissions in your career, so I was wondering and you seem to be busier now than you've probably ever been in your life, and so I was wondering what's next and, you know, where does Peter go from here?
Well, there are a whole lot of books coming out, that's exciting. I mean, and this was sort of based on the fact that for years I declined to have a book done, because I felt that the book in a way was like a biography of you, and it wasn't over yet. It was too early. It was too early to sum it up. And so it was only really when this most recent book came up. Marco talked about doing a book for, I don't know, 20 years, but I always held back. You know, suddenly it was right. And so Marco and I have done the book called One Man Show. But suddenly, coming at 2 o'clock today, Douglas Wilson is doing a book on alphabets, a kind of history of alphabets and all my alphabets, and I have a book about alphabets.
Yes.
So that's almost finished. There's a little nice little design series that Brian Webb edits. The first one was the Nash Brothers, and then it was Revilius and Borden, and they're all, it's a graphic design series, and there's a book coming out in that. So that's opened a lot of doors, the whole book world. But the things within the last year, I designed the carpets in the new, I don't know what it's called, in the law courts, the High Court. Mm-hmm. You know, so and I've worked on some fabrics for Stella McCartney, and I did a limited edition Levi design in Japan. And I've done some other work in Korea, some collage things. What else? I think something for Chelsea Football Club.
Yeah.
just recently for Adidas doing a collage where they photographed the players against it. So, and this opens new doors. You have always been a football fan, but not of Chelsea. But suddenly I was getting tickets each week. So I've seen this extraordinary end to the season with the 7-0 yes. game and the 8-0 game on Sunday. So, and that's been a pleasure. You know, so, and I'm still doing music stuff. I recently did a cover for the Blockheads. And they presented one of my most treasured awards. They had a Blockhead medal made in gold. You know the little black enamel one, that's the face that Barney Bubbles did. And I had a phone call from Norman Watts Roy, the bass player. Could he come over to the studio? I thought, that's odd. So he turned up, and one by one, all the Blockheads turned up, and they were all kind of, I didn't quite know why they were there, and they suddenly got rather shy and presented me with this wonderful medal.
Is that your most treasured award?
I mustn't say that. But it is a treasured award. No, I'm very proud to have the knighthood, so I wouldn't say it supersedes that.
Peter, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Write a book.
Another book. I'm about to start my autobiography. That rather odd little still life upstairs of an old typewriter in the laundry box.
It's
the beginnings of my autobiography, which I'm doing again. I've over the years I've been asked to do it and I've declined it because I felt I wanted to be completely honest, and I know I can't. You know, I know there are things I just don't want to talk about, so I've declined to do it. But I've worked out a way to do it which could work, is that I'm doing it with Genesis, who published those special books. Yeah. So it'll be a box with a series of sheets of paper, and each one would take a bit of my life. So it might be childhood, it might be whatever it might be, but it'll be either handwritten or typed on a very old typewriter or printed, and it will have a femur on each page. You know, so you know, things like tickets from jazz shows, things like that. So each page will be an essay, and by doing that, I can leave out everything I don't want. You know, I can